accession number 12030, rule 2.
Right, reel 2. Yes, now.
In America, where a visiting parliamentarian is invited, they sit with, in Congress, with the members. And I was privileged to be there when Mr. Churchill came out. As you will recall, he came out almost immediately after Pearl Harbor and gave his famous address to the Congress, House of Representatives and Senate. And he was a tremendous hero to them. He was very beloved by them, and of course he gave a marvelous, marvelous speech. And one was very proud to be in Parliament at that time with him, and very privileged to have served with him, because he was nothing if not colourful. And the relationship that you just asked about was very real. It has since then had moments when it was up and it was down. But essentially, there is a good deal we share, and also a good deal that we do not share, and one forgets. If you come from the East Coast of America, you forget that as you proceed to the West Coast, you are not surrounded by people, Anglo-Saxons from this country. You are surrounded by every nationality in the world. And, of course, I'm told, I don't know if it's true or not, but you get to the West Coast, the language there is Spanish. It isn't English anymore. So the position is totally different now. But even then, there was a difference between the geographical location in the United States.
What do you think the effects on your children were of having that time in America? You have already explained, you know, a few of the educational benefits for your son.
I would have said that's for them to answer. And as you are proposing to talk to my son, you must ask him that. But I would say that it had been nothing but a benefit. I think that they gained a great deal from it. I'm glad they came back at the time they did, but I'm sure they gained. But my son then went to New York as an adult and worked there for 7 years. My daughter knows America as well as any of us. And they, both the Rathbun children, and indeed my other daughter, they all know and love America. I don't think that it's a question that applies to our family. We are bifocal. And
did you ever have any criticism because your children were sent out of Britain in the war?
I don't think so. I think it was understood. You see, when we went to Cornwall originally, as a young couple starting in politics, they looked no more sideways at me being American than they would being English, because we were all foreigners. And it was a matter of great jokes that, between us, that in a way they almost treated me more as a native than they did my English husband. So I forget where...
I was asking about, you know, if anyone ever criticised you.
Oh, no,
sending
I see,
your
I see what
away.
You... Yes, I'm sorry, I lost the train of thought. For that reason, I don't think they thought it was strange at all. Again, because they went to family. Now, if it had been different and they were sent just into the unknown, then they might have said, how could you do it? But nobody doubted the validity of my case.
Coming back in 1944, as your children did... I imagine they came back to the V1s and V2s.
They certainly did. The very night they arrived, we had a beauty ride over the house. We used to get all the things that didn't hit Parliament and the Abbey. We had our full share. So in that time, then we moved them to the country. We didn't keep them in town.
Was that in you quite a readjustment for them to me?
Of course that was a readjustment, a tremendous readjustment. Yes, I mean, it was getting used to me as a mother again. I mean, they didn't expect that I was the one who heard the prayers at night. So all those things were an adjustment. But I think it was easier for my son than for the daughter, because she stayed at home. He went straight into a school with other little boys and some who had been in America. So it was, I think it was easier for him. She, I think, found it a little more difficult.
Another two.
Oh, you have, I see.
Yes. And I'd like to ask you very much, Lady Wright, about your experience as a lady in the House of Commons from 1941 to 45, because this must have been a very interesting period, I would think, to be an MP.
Well, I think, first of all, I have to say that going into the House of Commons, from the day I took my seat, completely altered my entire life. Because you then had a responsibility you never had had before, and a schedule, as we say in America, a schedule, which was much more than any human being can happily absorb, and so it is to this very day. But the demands made were, first of all, the constituency, because that was the place where I had done my tutelage, if you like, for the work I was about to do. I was very well aware of what their needs were, and I knew that in 250 villages you had to make yourself available at least once a year in each one, and no one would go to any other because they're very, very independent. And therefore, the first thing I had to work out was how I could manage to give them the service to which they had become accustomed without actually killing myself. The train journey to Cornwall at that time could take anything up to 24 hours. You very often had to stand because you felt obliged to let anything in uniform sit. I'm not quite sure that they worked any longer hours than we did, but that didn't matter. It was you had to let them sit. And I frequently sat 4 or 5 hours on a suitcase and then would get out of the train. I couldn't stay. Our house had been commandeered by a school in Plymouth, and they was not available to me, not that I would have wanted to stay there by myself. And I stayed quite a lot in Bodmin with a very generous constituent who happened to be the head of the police, and it was a good protection to me because I used to have to drive in the blackout myself from village to village down little country lanes such as we have in Cornwall in order to find perhaps 4 men and an oil stove. But this was where I was supposed to be, and our clinics, as they're called now, were extremely important because these people had terrible problems with divided families. We also had a huge population of the black regiments from the United States before D-Day, and this presented the little villages of Cornwall with problems which I don't need to elucidate, but left us with a heritage of khaki-colored children. But that was bound to happen. And there was that, the constituency, which made great demands. And then in Parliament itself, I lived in Dean's Yard, which was just back of the Abbey. And, of course, the meeting of the House of Commons became quite a problem. In the very beginning of the war, when I was not in the House, there were evacuation plans drawn up. And Stratford-on-Avon, as is now known, as it was not then, that was going to be the place where we were all going to go and meet. Well, that never came off because it was decided very rightly that our job was in London. The other people had to stay in London. We should stay in London. And we used to meet partly in Church House and partly in the Palace of Westminster. And you never knew where. It was always secret where the meeting was to be held. So you might go to the powers of Westminster and be sent to Church House or vice versa. Well, Church House was literally at my doorstep. I had about four steps to make before the steps up into Church House. So that was very handy. But we never knew which. The hours of time, the dates of the meetings, were all decided in secret session because of security. There were other matters also in secret sessions, but those were always that. And there was no particular record kept of the meetings, except a very overall recommendation by the speaker. And there was, it was all, we had changed our hours. We met from 11 to 4, which was unheard of. And then, of course, and we made a 5-day week of it. We had no long summer recess, for instance. And all of that, one sort of didn't pay much attention to. You just kind of took it in your stride. But the things which I wanted to interest myself in and which I had to were the things which really concerned my constituency, which was, as in everywhere in the country, housing. And there was a committee set up, of which I was chairman, to set up home helps and day nurseries and nursery schools. And the strange thing is that only last year my son himself had a research done by his son and a booklet produced on nursery schools. So the interest has gone through a few generations. Did I say home helps? Well, home helps were one of the things which we set up at that time.
Did you have much success with your nursery schools? You
know, well, it was only setting them up at the end of the war. We couldn't do much then. This was all post-war planning. This was getting ready for the great day of peace. I mean, we were not in a position to set up nursery schools with the bombs coming down and the people were all evacuated, the
but
children.
But were you able to get your sort of study scheme set up?
Oh, the schemes were all there. Yes. They had only to be put into action. How much is left of the original one, I can't tell you. Then we were very concerned with water supplies in Cornwall because we had hundreds of villages with no piped water supply. And to this day, I'm afraid, there are still remaining some. It is one of the things that has never been really tackled. So this was something that I got very interested in because the country as a whole, I find, is dependent on surface water. We don't have a lot of springs, and therefore we are very tied up to whatever climate we happen to be enjoying at the moment. And it's very easy for us to have droughts, and also floods, of course. But that was a thing I tried to study simply because it affected my constituents, and then, of course, you become interested in these things when you start taking them up. And the other thing was that our schools were not, the teachers were not even on the Burnham scales as they then existed. And they were in very poor shape, and there were many with no wooden floor, just the earth, no inside plumbing of any kind, and very half-hearted teaching. So when the Butler Bill came in, it was of immense interest, and Florence Horsburgh, who was then the Minister of Education, came down to the constituency, and we had a tremendous evening of question and answer with all the people concerned, which did a great deal of good and was very interesting for everyone. And, of course, the bill was handled well because we had a coalition. Would that we had one now when it comes to things like education, because we could really agree on that, I would have thought. Then we instituted a thing called Women's Days, which were days entirely devoted to women's subjects, debates in the House. I was frightfully against these, not because I didn't want to have women well treated, and not that I wasn't in favor of equal pay, which was the main reason for having these days, but largely because I felt it was a mistake that the men didn't feel part of it. I mean, the one needed the other. But anyway, they were Women's Days, and that was it. I had a wonderful step-great aunt-in-law called Eleanor Rathbun, who was the independent member of the Combined Universities, who was much better known than any of us. And it took her 35, 40 years to bring in family allowances. And they became law in her time. She was in the last years of her life, And I wheeled her in a wheelchair to the bar of the House of Commons for the final reading of the bill, which was really, for me, extremely moving. She seemed to be quite calm about it. She'd worked, as I think I just said, 40 or 45 years for this. The women, all women members, other women members, we were about 13 or 14 in number, but went up and down with people who came and went. They asked me if I would approach her to see whether she would accept, because she'd already been offered it and refused it, some sort of recognition for her services, in other words, an honour. So I had a little appointment with her to talk to her about it. And she was a very straightforward human being and a wonderful person. And she said, "No, Babs, I don't think so. I've achieved what I set out to, my family allowances. There's nothing to be gained. I'd have never believed in this." And her parents and grandparents had both been in the house. They had always refused it when they established district nursing and things of that kind, for which they were famous. So she refused to have it. I went back, and the women were disappointed. But there it is. The business of being a member was interesting anyway, but it had a particular problem, because by nature, I think if you become politically minded, you are rather critical of what is being done or what should be done. And we all felt that it really wasn't a time when we couldn't be very nagging. We could only just possibly nudge in our endeavors, our speeches, because there was so much at stake that was more important than water in Paul Ruin or a school in St. Clair, that you felt you really must be very controlled in your criticism of the government at that time. But it still existed. And in my maiden speech, I was very critical of the Normandy landings, which was a moment when one felt rather critical. But as I say, you nudged rather than nagged.
Well, why were you critical of the Normandy landings?
I forget exactly what was the main purpose, but it was a half-hearted affair, and it had a disastrous result. And it happened to be one of the things I wanted to talk about. Of course, as if I knew what could have been done better, of course I didn't. We didn't know. You see, we were awfully ill-informed. I mean, how could we not be? The security was very tight. It had to be very tight. Where we were meeting had to be secret, and what we said very often had to be secret. However,
yes, so that would be the Dieppe landings,
wouldn't it? No, it was long. No, long after that.
Yes.
No, it was in Normandy. Norway.
Oh, the Norway landings.
Yes.
Oh, I see, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, so we went on with our struggles, and when there was an air raid warning, some members would go down in the air raid shelter, wherever they were, and the speaker never felt he could go. And I was blessed with the fact that it simply didn't worry me. Now, it's nothing to be credited for. It's simply the way you're made. Some people were very, very frightened. I had an uncle staying with me who was a man of great, great bravery, and he simply was terrified because there was nothing he could do. He couldn't protect anybody. And so he was very unhappy. But I used to go and talk to the speaker, which is unheard of now. You don't go and talk to the speaker anymore. Well, this went on day after day, and then in May 1942, I married Paul Wright, who was a soldier in the King's Royal Rifle Corps. And because he was an old Westminster boy, we were allowed to be married in St. Faith's Chapel in the Abbey, to which I walked across from our house at 4B to the Abbey, on the arm of the uncle who was living with me and who'd been sent over by President Roosevelt to start a shadow admiralty ready for the time when America would come into the war. So we found ourselves, the day of the wedding, with Paul de Labillière, the Dean of Westminster, marrying us, Paul Hammond, who was my nearest and dearest relative giving me away, married to Paul Wright. So there's a very famous family photograph with the three great Pauls.
that.
Didn't like any member to change her name. Thelma Caslett changed her name to Keir, and I changed my name from Rathbone to Wright, and we were in very bad odour with the chair, who, poor things, they have to remember our names, and it was really asking a lot of them. What with the war, the doodles, the V1s and V2s, and two women members changing their name was a bit much for them to put up with.
I wonder how you felt. You know, first of all, your seat in Parliament, that came about because your husband died, is that right?
Oh, we had a by-election.
Yes, but and the, you were elected, were you?
Oh, yes, it was unopposed. There was a national government. It was a coalition, if you like. Is this going on? And it was decided that, where possible, the sitting member who had disappeared or been killed or whatever had happened, his party would put forward a candidate. My name was put forward, but I was supported by the other parties in the constituency, notably the Liberals, because, of course, it was Isaac Foote's old seat. And so the Liberals were the next strongest. The Labour had lost their deposit in the election. But I was unopposed. You get nominated, you have the formalities, but you don't have to fight an election, which was a mercy, because at that time it was difficult to work up election fever with the war going on. There were cases, however, the independent members in the war were increased from 9 to 33. It was a time, it was a good time for independents. A.P. Herbert was one of them. They had a lovely time. That was their great day, the war years, for the independent members.
Can you remember when you first went into the House, you know, to take up your duties? What was it, you know, quite a daunting thing?
Oh, of course, of course. Of course it I was introduced by the then Alfred, later Lord Bossum, and the Chief Whip, James Stewart. James Stewart was probably one of the most beautiful men I've ever laid eyes on. He was a great friend of my uncle Paul Hammond, who, as I think I've mentioned, was living with me. And when I was a student at Oxford, my uncle wrote to me and said, "I've asked my friend James Stewart to see you sometime. He's a member of Parliament." The letter came, and a short time later, a letter from James Stewart saying, "Would I come up and have supper or lunch or something, I forget." To me, at that time, in my late teens, I thought, of course, members of Parliament must be very white-haired, elderly, pompous, extremely difficult. So I put on the tweediest things I could, flat soles to my shoes, came up to London and went to the House of Commons. I was sitting in the lobby, with which I became very familiar later, when this Greek god came towards me and said, "I am James Stewart. Are you Babs?" I longed to say to him, "Yes, but I'd like to go home and change my clothes." He was very exciting for me at that age. But he introduced me to the House years later, as I say, Alfred did, and the procedure's the same today, so everybody knows about that. And, of course, it's daunting. And one thing that was very daunting was that Mr. Churchill was sitting on the front bench when I had to go past him, sign the book and everything, and he hated women members of Parliament. So he didn't smile or anything. He just looked as much as say, "Why did you have to come in here? You don't feel very welcome." But that you have to get over that. Well, where are we?
Yes. Still on the subject of the House of Commons, you mentioned the coalition and how this works so well in the war. You know, this would have been the Labour members working with
and
the Conservative
Liberal.
And the
all three parties,
well.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, it was very. You couldn't have had anything else in wartime. You couldn't be wasting time arguing on the policies of the various parties. This is what I mean about a nudge rather than nag. One long to, whatever your party, you long to have a say in the wielding of the power such as it was. But don't forget, we spent most of our time on the war effort. And the committees which I spoke of earlier were set up in others to keep us quiet, to occupy our minds with what was going to happen at the end of the war. And frankly, I don't think the Churchill himself was ever very interested in that. He was interested in carrying out the war, and it needed his full attention, and look at the success he had. But they wanted us to be thinking. The Housing Committee, which had, due to the fact we pushed it, they let some women onto it. There weren't any women to begin with. And those of us who went onto it rather late were presented with plans that they dreamed up. There wasn't a door you could get a pram through. There was nowhere to leave a pram, outside or in. It was unbelievable, the extraordinary lack of any imagination that went into these plans. Furthermore, having suffered from it, I once said to the gentleman who was presenting his plans, what about the freezing of pipes? I see they're all on the outside of your plan. Oh, he said, yes, it's so much easier to mend them when they freeze. There was nothing you could do about that.
Yes. The other thing that was interesting was the sort of working day. You know, you were saying that it started at 10, 11
no,
until
at 11.
4.
Well, it used to start it as it does today, at 2:30. Well, the working day, my dear, had nothing to do with the hours in Parliament. I mean, you had an enormous amount to do in this little office of mine where bundles in Britain were being carried on in one corner. You had committee work, too, which was not during the sittings of the House of Commons. And then you spent a great deal of time getting to your constituency and back.
Yes, I was thinking, though, you know, of Parliament in itself, because a lot of women MPs today are advocating just this, aren't they?
Hours. Oh, yes, but the men are too. I think it will come sometime, because it is really absurd that you sit up all night. You're not much good by 3 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the morning. And if you are, you shouldn't be.
And so, it seems to have worked during wartime.
Well, I think under stress these... I mean, you could do an awful lot when your country's at war that you could never do. We can now afford to be very rude about each other in Parliament. You couldn't afford it then. You couldn't possibly do it.
Yes. Did you find towards the end of the war, you know, 1944 and 45, when things were improving regarding the war, you know, and obviously victory was in sight.
You mean after D-Day?
After D-Day. Mm. Did you find that then the old antagonism started coming back?
Oh, that's a point that is to me, very interesting, because at the end of the war, when it became necessary, I mean, after the May 8th, the famous occasion when Churchill came to the House at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and stated and gave us the statement that the war in Europe had ceased, and we all processed from the House of Commons across the street to St. Margaret's for a very quick, short service of thanksgiving in which the names of those members who had been killed or who had died were read out.